Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
We're never going to reach kind of happy land. It doesn't exist. We might reach it for a short time and visit it, but we're never going to exist in happy land for the rest of our lives. So it's about kind of recognizing that there will be those ups and downs, which is quite different to the kind of societal story we have about striving and success. It's all about reaching for something and reaching for this kind of place you will get to where everything will be okay, which isn't possible. We will be okay many times, but we'll also feel bad and we'll feel sad and we'll feel anxious, but then we'll be okay again.
Hi, I'm Francesca Spector, and you're listening to Alonement, the podcast that broadens the conversation around alone time. Each episode, I ask my guest about the time they spend by themselves and why it matters. At the heart of every episode is one central question: what turns solitude into a good or bad experience? Because when alone time isn't lonely, it's alonement. So we're finally here. It is season 3 finale time. And before I start the episode, I just wanted to remind you that I have written a book. Alonement, How to Be Alone and Absolutely Own It is available in hardback, Kindle and audiobook editions. If you would like a sneak preview before ordering yours, I've included an exclusive clip from the audiobook at the end of this episode. Now, time for the episode, and might I add, what a banger to conclude with. My interviewee this week is Dr. Emma Hepburn, aka the Psychology Mum. I'm just going to come out and say it. Emma quickly became one of my all-time favourite interviewees within basically minutes of starting this recording. She's that magical combination of grounded, honest, and astonishingly wise. One moment she's your relatable best friend, the next she's throwing out brilliant, insightful nuggets of wisdom that make you pause for thought. For those who aren't already familiar with her work, Emma is an NHS clinical psychologist known for producing beautiful illustrations that demystify mental health concepts for the masses. Her Instagram page, The Psychology Mum, has over 100,000 followers and has proved a welcome balm for those struggling during lockdown. So, pretty much all of us then. She's also the author of A Toolkit for Modern Life, which is out now in hardback. I couldn't think of a better way to end this season than speaking to Emma, and I know you're going to fall in love with her like I did. Happy listening. Dr. Emma Hepburn, it is so wonderful to have you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to congratulate you because you've just been awarded the Points of Light Award by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. What an honour.
Yes, that was quite a surprise. I have to admit, when they first called me, I thought it was some sort of scam call. But no, it turned out it wasn't. They genuinely were from the Prime Minister's office and wanted to give me this award. So I then had a call with the Prime Minister just a couple of weeks ago. a Zoom call as well, and with my children video bombed so they could tell their friends the next day that the Prime Minister said hello to them, which he did.
That is amazing. I love that. It's the reality of homeschooling, which I know you've been doing. You can't, even if you're quite literally on the phone to the Prime Minister, you can't get a moment's relief and peace.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they were kind of stands in the door. I did give them permission to come in, but I think they would have come in without permission anyway. So yes, and that's probably a good example of how homeschooling works. Your children are just there constantly demanding your attention.
I think there's something nice about it, I do think, because it's almost like those veneers have dropped off. We almost get that picture of someone's home life.
Yeah, I like that. I like the fact that, you know, that we can see that you can't separate the person from the work. And I think for so long we've tried to pretend we are this work person and we're this home person. And of course, in some situations, that's quite helpful, having a kind of different mindset. But also, it's sometimes not that helpful because you can't really separate the fact you've got kids that you need to go and pick up when you're at work. And that creates stress if you're late. So I like the fact that's happened.
Yeah. It's interesting because, yeah, you can't necessarily separate that, but you very much, even in your Instagram handle, you very much acknowledge the fact that you are a mum. You are the psychology mum.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Also, I do try to keep, and I don't show my children Instagram, so I do try and keep it very boundaried in terms of professionalism. But when I was coming up with the name, and I think it was before I realised how popular it would become, I was like, well, what do? My two identities at the moment, and this was a couple of years ago, or I'm a psychologist and a mum. So it was as basic as that. Put the two of them together and that's my two identities. So, yeah.
That's interesting. So has it always been quite important to you to show that reality of your life, even if you don't explicitly show your children online?
Yeah, I think there, you know, this kind of view of an expert. So I know a lot about brains. I know a lot about mental health. Does that make me immune to how the brain works or to mental health? Of course it doesn't. You know, I still have a brain that functions like anybody else's brain. It still has the same bias and the same, you know, it's still drawn towards certain things. I think, you know, that separation of the person from the professional identity has kind of traditionally been what's happened. But actually, I think recognizing or showing that, you know, not in a very boundaried way, that we all have these same experiences, it's kind of common humanity, that brains work as they do, kind of normalizes that experience. And actually, even in my previous book, you know, I kind of slip in a couple of things about the reward areas of our brain and not being able to override it when I, for example, eat a multi-pack of crisps, because we're all prone to these things. You know, we all have mental health, we all have a brain, we all experience many of the same similarities across that. Of course, there's individual differences, but to pretend I don't would be unrealistic. To put myself on this pedestal, it's like I know everything about mental health and I know exactly how to apply it. Well, I do know a lot about mental health and I do know a lot about our brains, but applying it can still be hard at times because I still have the same fallacies that all humans have.
I think this is a perfect point to ask a question which I imagine you don't get asked all that often, which is, how are you? Because I know that you've been supporting, you know, I don't think it's even a stretch to say you've been supporting the nation, you've been supporting your family, you've been working as a clinical psychologist for the NHS throughout this pandemic. How are you coping with all that?
Yeah, I would say today, because the sun has come out, I'm feeling quite good. But January and February, I was definitely experiencing lockdown exhaustion. I think what had happened is that, you know, I like going out for walks in the evening. We had a really grim February and January in Scotland. That wasn't possible. So a lot of my coping strategies were taken away. And then the multiple demands, so children were at home, of homeschooling, trying to juggle a job or two jobs, because I also work at the university, trying to keep up with other demands which came in via the Instagram stuff. Just that kind of, I was overloaded with stuff or things to do. My brain was overloaded and you're pulled between all these different areas, and that's exhausting for your brain. Multitasking at that level is exhausting. I think you can feel like you're not succeeding in any of those, and that's exhausting as well. So yeah, I'm feeling quite hopeful right now because the sun's out. But had you asked me last week when it was torrential rain here, you would have got a very different story.
Yes, and that's very realistic. I know that in one of your brilliant illustrations, you do a sort of graph of, you know, emotions, and it really is, you know, it's a roller coaster as you draw it like this swirly line rather than this, you know, straight constant that we think. And it's, and that's why I really like, you know, the title of your book, A Toolkit for Modern Life. It's, I suppose the idea of a toolkit presupposes that things break or go wonky, and to have a toolkit almost, I don't know, it almost allows that reality.
Yeah, and I think it's also applying the right tool at the right time for you, and what works for you might be slightly different. So I think the idea is that things will go wrong in life, and you're like, things go wrong in your house, things break in your house, you have a toolkit for it. It's inevitable that things will go wrong in your life and that you will sometimes feel bad. That's life. We can't help feeling bad. We can't help feeling anxious at times, but it's about knowing what you can do about it and how you can help yourself. It's not trying to avoid feeling bad or trying to avoid feeling anxious all the time, which is actually unhelpful. It's trying to find the things that you can best do to help yourself when that happens. So I think that's how the toolkit analogy works. It's also about realistic expectations about how emotions work, expecting at times life will throw things at us and we will feel bad.
Mm. And your pandemic toolkit, you were saying that walks have been a really useful tool for you. You know, do you think that that almost has been, yeah, much more of a challenge just because of something like the weather?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first lockdown, obviously there's been different lockdowns and different numbers of lockdowns in different countries, and Scotland is slightly different to England, but in the first one we were all in that lockdown. If you remember the beautiful weather of spring, March, it was stunning. We were sitting outside homeschooling, we were out on beautiful walks, the days were getting longer, and that enabled us to do things which helped us cope. In a winter lockdown, I mean, people feel quite often bad in the winter time anyway, or feel worse because they're not getting the same level of light, the same level of time outside. But also what it did, like you mentioned, was take away a lot of those coping strategies we normally use. So, you know, you don't want to sit outside with a friend or walk outside with a friend if it's pelting down with rain or torrential snow. So it's just that kind of practicality of taking away those things that help us cope. And also, I think everybody was just absolutely exhausted. And I walk around the hospital, the staff look exhausted. Everybody was already exhausted. So we're coming from a different base where people are already having kind of difficult emotions. There's difficult emotions, obviously, with a pandemic, but that was with a kind of layer of exhaustion on top of it, which was a kind of additional thing we had to get through. And also kind of hope, I think, in the first wave or the first lockdown, we had hope that it wouldn't last long. It was this kind of camaraderie that we were all in it together. And I think holding on to hope during those winter months, not knowing when it was going to end, not knowing when it was going to be light again, was really difficult. And I think that's why the sunshine, to me, has just made me go, okay, yes, we do get spring and nice weather in Scotland. I've started to feel quite hopeful about it again. But when your mood is already low, what we do is we predict the future based on that current mood. It's called effect anchoring. So we anchor our predictions about how we currently feel. And if we currently feel bad, it can be hard to see us feeling any other way in the future. So you really have to force your brain to kind of think, but last March was beautiful. It was really nice. And I did feel good, even though there was, you know, times I felt stressed last March, I did feel good. In the sunshine, there was things I could do to make myself feel good. So it's reminding yourself about those little pockets of hope and seeing the spring bulbs come up, whatever it is. It's not about trying to say I shouldn't feel that way. It's saying there is still hope here and I can hold on to that because I will feel a different way in the future.
That's fascinating. Effect anchoring. And that's, and so it's based almost on, I suppose, an acquired wisdom. Because we have, I suppose, you know, we always use the word unprecedented, but now we have a precedented spring during the pandemic, which, as you say, had moments of okayness.
Yeah, yeah. And it's helping your brain remember that. So when it's feeling bad or exhausted, because our brain is designed to process lots of complex information very, very quickly. if we processed everything that was going on in the world, our brain would be constantly overloaded and wouldn't work. So it has lots of shortcuts. And one of those is what I described, kind of anchoring itself onto what's going on right now to predict the future. But also we have a real kind of threat negative bias. So we'll notice that, and it has a stronger impact on our brain than positive things. So sometimes you almost have to work against your own brain to kind of get yourself through these things, and have an understanding about how that works, I think, can be really helpful to say, okay, yes, I am noticing all these threats out there, but I know that's because my brain is picking up on that kind of negative bias and being threat orientated.
Wow. I mean, my brain is absolutely fizzing from everything you're saying already. I wonder, so this podcast is about being alone. You know, I wonder how much that state of aloneness comes into both identifying and also exercising that toolkit. And I know it's different. I know everyone has a different toolkit. As you say in your book, we all have different tools. But like, what relationship is there between creating our own toolkit and using it and spending time alone?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think aloneness, some choice, let's say. Aloneness, so I'm going to focus on two things. So aloneness from choice and lack of social connection, which is a different thing. So aloneness from choice gives your brain a time to and downregulate and process things and think things through. It also is almost about a time to make connections in your brain that you wouldn't have, which you wouldn't necessarily make when your brain is kind of action orientated. When you pause, parts of your brain link together. I come up with ideas in those times. So for me, it's alone time is definitely a part of my toolkit, because it enables me just to kind of relax, engage my rest and digest system in my body, and gives me time to be creative and come up with ideas. I love spending time alone. But I guess there's other side where we know that social connection is one of this, or is the strongest predictor of positive mental health. So if you don't have the opportunity for social connection, if it's not a choice to be alone, if it's you don't have agency in deciding to be alone, I guess, then it can be a really negative thing, because then that creates stress. So loneliness can create stress if it's not a choice. Being alone, not as a choice, as loneliness, which creates stress, which has an adverse effect on our mental health and well-being.
Yeah, and I definitely, you know, I want to come on to loneliness a little bit later in this podcast, because I think that especially during this pandemic, it's been a whole other beast and something that's been almost, you know, central to everyone's experience of it in some way. But, you know, I wonder, is there a world in which alone time could, you know, not feature in someone's toolkit? Is there, do you think that someone can have a healthy, emotionally regulated state of being without spending any time alone?
I think that's very individual, isn't it? I think some people thrive through social connection and don't need the same level of downtime. I think it's very individual. I think most people do need some time alone, or some time certainly to downregulate their brain. That might not necessarily be totally alone, but might be sitting with a person and not speaking. So I think time to downregulate your brain, or time to daydream, or time to potter, whether that's alone, and for many people it will be, or whether it's with somebody else, but not having to actively think, is really beneficial. But I think it's very individual. I think it's that kind of downtime, that down regulation of the brain, the kind of relaxation of the brain. Some people might do it with somebody else, but for me, I like doing it alone.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you can kind of be almost alone together with someone if you can achieve a comfortable silence to read during or to create during, but you'll be beside someone.
I guess actually coming back to it, it's sometimes about flow, and flow is thought to be when your attention is in the moment doing something and you're caught up in that, and your brain isn't thinking about other things. Now, I guess that is possible to other people. You certainly get flow from doing certain things like exercise, but often flow does come from doing things by yourself, like reading, or just being really involved, gardening for some people, creative things for some people, exercise for some people. And often those things are when you're alone. You might have people beside you, but actually your focus is not on being distracted by other people. Your focus is on the thing you're doing and being totally into the thing you're doing. And that state of flow is thought to be very good for well-being.
I'm interested in your creative flow, because of course you produce these incredible illustrations, and to start with, I imagine that requires a certain amount of time and probably time alone to create. How long do they take? Are you totally alone when you're doing them? What is your process, and does it involve alone time?
Well, if you look at my Instagram page, you'll probably notice I have done none in the last 2 months because of how busy I've been. I have some that I've done. I did write a column for the Telegraph, so I've got those on it that I did for them, because I had to have them in for a certain time. But in terms of ones that I've just come up with ideas from, I did the first one about 2 days ago. I think that was about the first this year, because they require exactly that. I think the first thing they require is an idea. Now, the ideas often come to me at the most random points, usually when I'm giving my brain a break, not trying to think of ideas. So in the shower, when I'm out for a walk, when I'm pottering around the house, I have been showering, obviously, but other things, being out for a walk by myself, or just having time to let my brain kind of mull things over, have not been happening recently. So ideas have not been happening because I haven't had time alone. And also, yes, the drawings are done when I'm alone. I find it hard to shift between things if I'm doing it. So I would spend an hour to a couple hours probably doing one, depending on the complexity of it. And I'm also often incorporating ideas that people have given me, which I ask for via Instagram. So it takes a while to do that, and I just haven't had that time. And that for me is very much a process of flow. When I'm sitting doing a drawing, I like to just do the drawing. I really enjoy it. It's actually probably one of my coping strategies, which is why I've done so many during the kind of first part of the pandemic, because that was a way for me to process what I was hearing, process what I was thinking, and just relax. I really enjoy it. It's really relaxing sitting drawing.
Well, thank you so much for that honesty, because I think, I think a lot of people will relate to that, not having been able to sort of create and, again, even just take that physical alone time over the past 2 months. A lot of parents out there having had to homeschool during this time, while balancing work, all of that, you don't have those moments alone. And of course, you say that the first 2 months of this year, because we're recording at the end of Feb, have been very difficult for you, and it's interesting and very honest to hear that that coping strategy has slipped, and that's mm-hmm. been that's been difficult for you. So I'm sorry to hear that, but it's interesting to hear it was also a coping strategy during the first lockdown as well. And there was almost a dialogue on Twitter, I remember, where people were saying, look, this isn't the time to write your first novel, this isn't the time to do X. But I suppose what was lost during that narrative was that I saw all your work during that time, and I thought, I am so grateful for everything that you're doing. And there's a beautiful sense of connection there, that was also helping you, that it was almost like a self-medicating thing.
Yeah, so I think that's the thing, it's when you start feeling pressure to do these things, and that's what I think a lot of people were touching on in the first wave, was you shouldn't feel pressure to do things just because people are telling you that's how to cope. However, if it is helping you cope, then, and it's not a pressure, then it's beneficial. And certainly for me, it was often once the children had gone to bed, I would sit down and just draw something out, or I'd have an idea. And sometimes used to stay at work a little bit longer, probably shouldn't say that in a podcast, when I wasn't actually working, I was just doing the drawing. So just because I was still going to work throughout the pandemic, so sometimes that would just give me a little time, almost like a kind of a time after I'd worked and a break between coming home. So that's just used little periods of time like that, and I shouldn't have just admitted that, but my husband doesn't listen to hot podcasts, so it's fine. so it's trying to find those little bits of time to do it. But for me, it was really enjoyable doing it, even though sometimes I'm writing about quite difficult things. I think also the feedback I get about how helpful it is to people is also hugely beneficial for me to hear, because it makes that time not just worthwhile for me, but worthwhile for other people as well.
Absolutely. And I think at the beginning of your book, you write about your pillars of mental health. And the first one of them is connection. And I think that what you did through those illustrations, well, they were something that you did, as you say, in that sort of sneaky, sneaky alone time tacked on to the end of work.
That's exactly what it was.
it's something that came out of your alone time, but it created so much connection. I mean, I've done the whole of lockdown alone, but I was doing the first 2 months during that period where we couldn't see anyone, even meet anyone for a walk. I was doing it completely alone. And I felt so seen in your illustrations. I felt so much less, I think so much less lonely in what was going on. And I think that that's a part of why they caused such a big stir and created such a following during this time.
That's really interesting, actually, when you say that, because I think actually part of being alone is thinking that you are different sometimes. So as psychologists, we talk about normalizing experiences. So if somebody comes in to meet me and they are telling me, I shouldn't be feeling like this, is it abnormal? Actually, most of the time, when you look at what they've been through and you piece their story together, it makes absolute sense. And saying actually something along the lines of, many people who go through that experience, or lots of people I hear would feel exactly the same way, or something like, I'm not actually surprised that you feel like that, I haven't heard your story, I feel quite stressed just hearing it. It takes away that kind of, I am different, I am abnormal, I am alone. And actually it normalizes and says, we are part of common humanity. We all have similar experiences. It's very validating to think, this is not me being different, reacting this way. It's me being human. And that, seen as human or seen as kind of common humanity, brings you together, really, doesn't it? In those experiences, which can be quite isolating and make you feel alone. So I think that normalizing and validating experience, actually, I hadn't thought of that, but I really like that description. It actually reduces feeling alone.
It's true. And I think, you know, alone is one of those words. I honestly think it has so many more meanings than we give it credit for. And you know, that is, of course, an objectively, you know, difficult feeling of being alone, that feeling that, oh, only I am feeling this. And I think when you see something on social media as well, you know, if you see one of your posts and, you know, it looks amazing and it comes from your account and you've got a really big following and you get, you know, all these thousands of people liking and commenting, suddenly it feels okay to feel those things. It's an odd one. We talk about social media and, you know, it's a double-edged sword, but I think creating that social element around sort of, you know, what might have been seen as a stigmatized emotion.
Yeah. And I think stigma itself makes you feel alone. So it makes you feel different, that nobody else is like this. And if you think nobody else is like this, you're going to feel isolated. But that validation, like you described, that validation, oh, other people do feel this way. And I've got probably the perfect example which came up. So I did a post kind of touching on what we spoke about, my first drawing this year, I think, about holding on to hope. And then some people read that, and obviously people read things differently, but some people read it as, oh, I should be feeling positive, which is not what I was saying. I was saying that when you're feeling difficult emotions, it's really helpful to try and spot signs of hope. But obviously people read it through their own kind of belief system. So a couple of people got in touch with me saying, I'm actually not feeling hopeful. I'm about the lockdown lifting. I'm feeling that I'm actually feeling quite anxious. And is this normal? And I just wrote back saying, yes, of course it's normal. Many, many people are feeling that.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
And I actually asked this person if I could share their comments on my stories, that I'll do anonymously because many people are feeling this way. I think it would be really helpful to let other people know that, you know, you don't have to be feeling joyous, which is how the news and, you know, social media is often portraying it as lockdown lifts. It's totally, you know, normal to feel anxious. So I shared her totally anonymized comment on my stories, and the response I got was huge. People were saying, thank you for sharing this. You know, I thought it was just me. I thought, you know, it was a bit weird. I was feeling this way. I was trying to hide it. But now I feel that lots of people feel this way. And yes, lots of people are feeling that way. So however you're feeling in response to the situation, there'll be many, many other people feeling that way. And if you think you should be feeling a particular way, for example, joyful or happy all the time, then it will make you feel isolated and alone.
Yeah. Do you think there's... I'm trying to unpick this in my mind. Do you think there's sometimes this almost like angsty teenager within all of us that wants to feel that we are alone in a certain emotion, that something's bigger than the world around us?
I think more so it's about kind of societal beliefs about how we should be. And I think there's this kind of story throughout society that we reach a peak point of adulthood and we will be okay. And that is us, we're sorted. And at that point, we will feel happy for the rest of our lives, that kind of happy ever after. And I think as a teenager, you're trying to find your identity, you're trying to kind of find where you are in life. And then you think you're going to get this peak point, but actually none of us get that peak point. We might feel we've got to it for a very short time, possibly, probably not. And then we change. But this belief that you're trying to reach this peak point, and that's kind of this nirvana of happiness and how we feel, I think makes us feel we shouldn't be feeling lots of different ways. When actually, like you described, that waves of emotion, we go up and down all the time. It's perfectly normal for us. We're never going to reach kind of happy land. It doesn't exist. We might reach it for a short time and visit it, but we're never going to exist in happy land for the rest of our lives. So it's about kind of recognizing that there will be those ups and downs, which is quite different to the kind of societal story we have about striving and success. It's all about reaching for something and reaching for this kind of place you will get to where everything will be okay, which isn't possible. We will be okay many times, but we'll also feel bad and we'll feel sad and we'll feel anxious, but then we'll be okay again.
Oh, Emma, you know, I'm so soothed just by hearing that.
Good.
You've been working as a NHS clinical psychologist throughout this time as well. How has the, you know, we talk about living in a loneliness epidemic, and that predates the pandemic. You know, we were talking about loneliness before and we're talking about loneliness now. And okay, in a, you know, fairly basic way, you might think that during a lockdown, we are lonelier because we're allowed, the government allows us less social connection than before. But do you think that, is it as simple as that? How has, you know, loneliness, that narrative played out this year from what you're seeing?
Yes, I think there certainly is more isolation, and isolation not through, well, isolation is very rarely through choice, but loneliness and people not having the connections that they want, and that is impacting on well-being and mental health. I mean, obviously some people are very good at keeping up connection online or in different ways, but that kind of group connection, which is kind of the fabric of our society, isn't it? The connections we have, the people we link into, those small points of connection, just saying hello to somebody in the street, are all valuable and all provide an identity of who we are as people, but also serve a purpose for us as individuals. It makes us feel good, it validates us, allows us to talk through things, and they're just not so readily available. We have to almost work to create those social connections at the moment. And when you're feeling a bit rubbish anyway, even putting the work into get those social connections can be really hard. So I certainly think the kind of fabric of social connection is not totally lost, because there's lots of people keeping it up with phone calls, with internet, with, you know, going out and meeting people as is allowed during lockdown. But the naturalistic kind of social connections in society just haven't been available to us in the same way, which certainly impact on us. But hopefully it'll be shorter term. We are naturally social beings, and I'm sure that will bounce back, and that fabric, that social connection will build up again and benefit us all. But it's just naturally been taken away by what's happened, which impacts on how people are feeling.
Absolutely. And I've seen some really interesting stats that actually I don't think was spoken about so much before this year, that before the past year, that, you know, 16 to 24 year olds are one of the loneliest demographics, in some studies the most lonely. And I think that, do you think that perhaps this year has brought attention to that in a way that there wasn't any before?
Yeah, I think that's interesting, isn't it? Because you think of that group as a very social group of kind of students going out. But I think even if you think about all the new things that are happening in that age, we're often leaving school. We've got a set group of people, whether you enjoy being with them or not, you might be quite thankful to leave school, but you're certainly moving on and you're trying to form usually new relationships. So whether you're going to university or into a job. So it's in a time of huge transition in your life, and transitions require creating new social connections, require putting yourself into unusual and often stressful new situations. There's a lot of stress in those age groups. And, you know, going out as a student, you don't naturally fall into the people that you want to be with. That takes a little bit of time. So even though you're in huge groups of people often, I remember starting university and being hundreds of people there. But actually, in those hundreds of people, you have to find the two or three people or whatever number that you actually really connect with. And it can actually be quite lonely in huge groups of people. Doesn't look at, you know, I live close to the university. I look across, not right now, obviously, and see hundreds of students. It looks hugely socially connected. But people can be really lonely in that huge amount of people as well, because they haven't found those links. And it's about finding those links in themselves can be quite stressful. So I think it's a period of huge transition and uncertainty, and finding your identity and finding the people that you actually want to be with and you actually want to connect with, and what you as a person connect with, because we don't often know. And we often don't find out until we're a bit older about what actually makes us feel connected and what makes us feel good. Mm. So I think, yeah, it's a huge period of transition.
And do you think there's any reason for optimism after this year? Because I think that the stigma around these conversations about loneliness, I can certainly say I've felt more liberated to speak about any loneliness that I've felt as someone living alone during this time. I felt liberated to talk about loneliness probably for the first time in my life. I don't think I would ever have been having honest conversations about loneliness with my friends, who all, again, whether they're living with housemates, partners, family, whatever, they're all experiencing loneliness too. And do you think that there's almost a room for optimism in that we are finally acknowledging loneliness, so perhaps we can speak about it going forward, pandemic or otherwise?
Yes, I think there's huge optimism in a few things. I think, first of all, you know, loneliness has quite a stigma to it. You know, being alone, should we feel lonely? We should be feeling, you know, we should be sociable. We should be feeling happy. It's that kind of shoulds again about how we should be feeling. Mm. And the pandemic has almost, like you say, raised this issue up that loneliness is not something to feel stigma about. It's something, you know, a real thing that many people feel. And actually, strangely, that in itself, recognising that other people feel loneliness starts to make you feel connected. Because if you think I shouldn't be feeling this way, again, that disconnects you, makes you feel isolated. But I think the other thing that it's done, which loneliness is closely connected to, it started to raise up the mental health discussion. And I've seen this across so many places. I think, you know, we'd already got quite good at talking about mental health, but there still is a huge stigma and kind of seeing this kind of binary view of there's people with mental health issues and then there's the rest of the population, which is just not true. We all have mental health. And because I think so many more people are experiencing the impact on their well-being and mental health, I think we're raising that up as an issue as well. And I've seen huge changes in terms of how that's been managed. So, for example, thinking about staff well-being, so many people are suddenly interested in their staff well-being. Staff well-being has always been there, but suddenly we're starting to see that isolation in the workplace impacts on people. We're losing those kind of non-specific work, work, what's the word? I'll think of the word here. I'll start the sentence again. So we're losing those non-specific parts of work. For example, having a coffee or meeting somebody at the water machine, which are so important for little connections. And there you might have a little discussion about something, a problem you've experienced. Or you might just say, did you see a soap opera last night? But all these little social connections have gone predominantly. And we're starting to see that impact of isolation and loneliness in people in their work settings as well. So it's raised these issues up in terms of isolation and mental health in tandem. And we're speaking about them and we're taking action on them, which I think is really good. How do we target this and how do we manage this? And I have seen so much more information and direct action at managing mental health in the workplace, with staff in the NHS, and thinking about which groups are isolated and how we can manage that as a society. Because so much mental health work is not done in a treatment room, it's done in communities and society, and it's so important.
That's lovely. And I think, yeah, I love, you know, what you say about, yeah, we see mental health as just something that you treat, or, you know, you go and, you know, you go and see someone once you're feeling particularly lonely or particularly isolated. But no, as you say, yeah, we are sort of acknowledging that community and even sort of workplace interventions. I suppose I was working in an office up until the February before last, just before I started writing the Alonement book. And I must say you've made me feel quite normal there, because after I left the office and working from home, I kind of kept thinking, oh, I really miss seeing, let's call him Tom. His name wasn't Tom, although there were about seven Toms in my last workplace. But I really miss seeing Tom first thing in the morning, because we used to get in at the same time and have a cup of tea. And it was someone I'd never thought about being a big part of my life, but it was just some part of your routine, I suppose. It's that way that your colleagues become your family in a really strange way. And that, you know, that we say family, that might be a distant cousin that you only see at Christmas, but they do, they factor in, and they sort of, they play into that wider picture of, you know, sustaining you so that you don't feel lonely. And I suppose, yeah, it's nice that we might be honest about that, that going back to the workplace, or, you know, personally, I'm thinking about joining a co-working space. So, you know, going back to whatever scenario we were in pre-pandemic, it's nice to think we might start to appreciate that and look at it a bit more mindfully, I suppose, for what it does represent and the very real role it does play in our mental health.
Absolutely. I think looking at the value of those things we perhaps haven't valued before, like you see the non-specific work parts that catch it up, having a laugh, that in a meeting, something I've lost, which I really enjoy, is in a meeting, is catching somebody's eye and you know they're thinking the same thing as you. I just really like when you do that. You don't have to do anything, you just catch their eye. And it's something really imperceptible almost, that you know that person's thinking the same thing. You can't do that in a Zoom meeting. So it's these real non-specifics that of connection that we're missing. That is often knowing that you're thinking the same thing as somebody else, or speaking something through and problem solving around something, which have been lost because we are just getting on with our work without that. But those are so important. People now are finding kind of some really practical ways to build those into the workplace, building the connections and reflective spaces and those non-specific ways or important parts of work into the workplace. And I like that. And I think that's going to continue on. So, like you say, a communal workspace, some people are doing things like, which to me sounds like hell, but some people like kind of working alongside people, but not speaking, and then kind of catching up at the end. Now, that's not for me, but it is for some people. So again, it's very individual what works for everybody. But people are thinking about it more, I think.
It's true. You've reminded me, actually, and I do want to plug this because it's just a wonderful facility. While I write independently for most of the day, I do something called Writer's Hour every morning, run by London Writer's Salon. It's a session where we all sit and write in silence for an hour at 8 a.m. And it would have seemed like the weirdest thing before this year to imagine us all doing that, or just sort of staring at each other on our screen via this giant Zoom of about 300 people. But God, it's been the game changer. It's probably, talking of toolkits, it's probably been one of the key tools throughout this year. And yeah, it's nice. I suppose it's nice to appreciate that. I like that we've almost taken ourselves back to that stage where we're children and we'll sort of walk up to each other in the playground and say, will you be my friend? You know, we're acknowledging these important things.
And imagine it's quite motivating as well. There's a really interesting, and I can't actually remember who spoke about this, but I think it was possibly Aristotle who talked about our second self. And actually we almost need that second self to keep us motivated and do things. And certainly in the modern research, it shows that if we agree to do something with somebody else, just like you have with that writer circle, we're more likely to do it. And we're more likely to commit to it. And then we've got an achievement which makes us feel good. So the classic example is if I agree to go out for a walk with somebody else, if it's just in my own timetable, I might not do it because who am I going to, you know, it's just myself. I'm not going to lose out much. But if I'm meeting a friend for a walk, I don't want to let her down. So I do it. And then, of course, I really enjoy the walk. I have a chat with her. So that second self helps you gain lots for yourself and be motivated and you're more likely to do something, achieve something. So I love that idea.
I want to move on to the idea of alonement, which I like to finish up every episode speaking about. You know, alonement is much like the mental health toolkit that you speak about. It's different for everyone. Could you describe a little of how your alonement works?
Well, at the moment, not very well at all, because I don't get very much. And that in itself, I would say I'm the master of alonement. I love spending time alone. And when I don't, I find it's quite detrimental to me. So, I mean, alone time for me can mean anything from just having brain space and no distractions and not having to multitask on other people and just focus on what I'm doing. And that can be anything from just pottering around the house, which I haven't done for a long time, unfortunately, or going out in the garden or writing or drawing a picture. But really for me, it's about not having to multitask and think of other people's needs. It's just focusing on what I'm doing. So it's a real luxury. And I don't think I'd ever be bored being alone because there's so many things I like to do and so many ideas I have. So I find it, I just love being alone. I've been alone on many occasions in various places. I've gone on holiday alone and used to work in Orkney by myself, and I used to love spending that time by myself. It's just, yeah, I love it.
Yes, I love that you say that you'd never be bored being alone because you have so many things. Do you think that that's something that comes out of being a mum as well? Do you think that you almost gain that appreciation for alone time that maybe you wouldn't have had before?
Yes, I think that's definitely the case. It becomes more precious. So, you know, being able to meander. I mean, I probably meandered all the time before kids. Now meandering and just want, even meandering around a shop. I mean, even a supermarket with kids, you don't meander. You go and get what you need and you get out. So even being able to stop and think, right, which, you know, packet of pastry. I mean, I haven't bought pastry in years, so it's a rubbish example. But which packet of pastry am I going to get? Which one looks best for me? I'll get that one. And having the time to think, rather than I need to get this now, is just, I think you start to appreciate the luxury of just having that meandering time. I've always enjoyed meandering, but I think I probably place hugely more value on it now when I have time alone, when I have walks, or when I have any time, pockets of time alone. I think the value has increased exponentially since having kids.
That's interesting. Yeah, someone else I spoke to, they described alone time as a sort of fluctuating commodity. Again, the idea of luxury comes into it.
Yeah, it is luxury for me right now. So I don't know how I would have been prior to having kids 10 years ago. I certainly did always like spending time alone, but it probably was more available to me. So I probably didn't enjoy it as much. I think the reduction in availability in alone time has upped its value because I need it. I don't get it so much. So its value is, I mean, it's precious to me, hugely precious. And actually a really interesting piece of research from the first pandemic, which I think was conducted in Finland, which looked at how parents coped. And there's a few kind of key findings that came out. One was kind of lowering their standards, you know, let kids watch TV a bit more, or just not having to meet the same family kind of standards they normally had. The second one was scheduling in time for each parent to be alone. And I thought that was really interesting. And certainly for me, that works. Just having time to yourself to do something you choose to do rather than to have to meet the needs of everybody else.
Yes. And does that work at play, that scheduling that alone time?
sometimes. Yeah, I mean, I have to say it worked a lot better when it was light in the evenings. We were starting getting lighter here. But, you know, in January and February here, we're dark until you know, where well, it's dark about 3:30, 4:00. So the time, pockets of time I used to spend alone would be going out for walks in the evening by myself, but it's just not so possible because of the weather. So I think it's what I started doing was having a bath just about every evening just to get time alone because nobody's going to disturb you in the bath. But I think scheduling it in does help, and certainly having it for me helps a lot. But yeah, the scheduling with a family, you have to have a flexible schedule, and that's actually something else that helped. But sometimes the thing that goes in that flexible schedule is the thing that meets your own needs. It often goes first, sadly, so is that alone time.
Yeah, because alone months, one of the biggest, I mean, probably one of the most outward facing manifestations of your own alone month is your beautiful illustrations, which, you know, you, as you say, you need that alone time for them. And that sort of had to fall to the wayside the past couple of months.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think even the alone time to enable those ideas to come. So enable the kind of brain connections to put together to process a piece of information I maybe got during the day from somebody, something somebody had said on Instagram, and thinking, oh, that would make a good illustration. I didn't even have the time to do that. So, I, you know, that alone time for me is also about the generation of ideas. I'm not necessarily sitting thinking I'm going to come up with ideas, because I don't come up with ideas when I think that, but they happen when I'm doing something else. And they always tend to happen when I'm doing something else. They pop into my head. And the decentness popped in my head at work, but I don't remember them because I'm so busy doing other stuff. But when I'm, you know, alone or having that kind of alone time, that's when I will have an idea, then have time to think about the idea and think about what I, how I could kind of draw that idea. So the image then comes to mind as well beyond the idea. But that's having brain space. Yeah. And I haven't had much recently.
Alone month is something that, you know, I am biased, but, you know, I know that again, you know, I'm like you, I think that, and, you know, I'll hold my hands up again that the past couple of months I've probably been neglecting my alone months in that, for instance, I haven't been journaling as much. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's my thing that I know sustains me. But something I do struggle with, and I think perhaps maybe a lot of listeners will be struggling with, when do you know that you should, or how do you know, rather, how do you know when you should be prioritizing alone time, and how do you know when you should be prioritizing social time? And, you know, how do you make that call of what you need for your mental health in that moment?
Well, I think nobody gets this right all the time. I think we all kind of have to go with what feels right for us at the time. And I think it's really difficult because our brains also often predict the wrong thing. So it predicts what will make us happy, or what it predicts will make us happy is not necessarily what will always make us happy. So I think it's really difficult, but I think it's just thinking, noticing how you're feeling as much as possible, because that's the first thing you need to actually be aware of how you're feeling. Mm. And thinking, what would help me right now? What do I feel like I need right now according to how I'm feeling? You won't get it right all the time. Sometimes you'll maybe speak to somebody on the phone, you come off feeling worse, and that wasn't the right thing to do. And sometimes you'll spend some time alone, then you'll start, you know, thinking, oh, I should be doing this, I should be doing that. So actually the time alone becomes unhelpful. But I think it's also noticing that, starting to notice patterns, and you start to build up and understand when something will be helpful. But don't think anybody can make that decision all the time about what's right for them all the time. But it's trying to notice how you're feeling and thinking, what do I need now? What do I want to know? What would be helpful for me now? When you have the time to do that, of course.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I think we're all learning throughout life about what works for us when, and we all get it wrong at times.
That awareness, because again, be aware, that's the second of your pillars of mental health. That requires a certain amount of aloneness, even if it's not physical alone time. How do you do that? What would be your sort of top tip for, you know, gaining that awareness in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, I think time to reflect, building in some time to reflect. So for example, at the end of the day at work, even building in 5 minutes, or after you've been writing for a bit, thinking, right, okay, so what worked well there, or how was I feeling, just reflecting on what's done. You know, often we're on to the next thing, but I think building in reflection time is really important. And also in that reflection time, say, well, how am I feeling now? You know, what's actually going on? What's going on in my body? How am I feeling? What am I thinking? So just stopping and pausing, even for a couple of minutes, and thinking about how you're feeling, because we're so often just going on to the next thing And that pausing can be thinking about how you're feeling in the here and now, but also just reflecting on what you've done and reflecting on how you felt when you did things. So you're kind of building up an awareness of, okay, after I, you know, wrote that piece of work and then phoned somebody, but actually that was really unhelpful. So thinking back kind of on what you've done, or thinking after I wrote that piece of work, I then sat in a cup of tea and thought about it and that was really helpful. So it's reflecting on what's been helpful for you, but also reflecting on how you feel now. And I think building in bits of reflection time, and I talk about in the book having a to-da list, which is really a chance to reflect on your day and also reflecting what went well. What did I do that worked well? And that might be thinking, well, I actually then spent 5 minutes alone after, you know, doing a really busy piece of work in that meeting, and that worked really well for me. So you have to notice, be aware of A, how you're feeling, B, what worked for you, and C, what didn't work for you. And it's only by knowing that you can kind of build up in the future and learn from that and kind of think about what does work for you, because there's not one thing that works for anybody all the time. And it's about learning what works for you. And that's kind of a lifetime process, and knowing that you'll get things wrong at times, and that's okay.
Oh, well, Emma, that is so, again, it's so soothing to hear. The resounding thing I hear from everything you say is it is okay, it is normal. And, you know, as I said earlier, I feel so seen. And I know so many of us feel so seen from everything you do. So thank you for all your work. And I'm so excited to see what you produce in the future. And, you know, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
And now for an exclusive clip from Alone Month, How to Be Alone and Absolutely Own It, the audiobook. And yes, that is me reading it. You need to work on your solitude skills, said no one, ever. We hear a lot about social skills, however, the tools we need to interact harmoniously with other people. Social skills involve communicating effectively with others, working well together, actively listening. Developing these skills is a key focus in so many areas of life, from early years education to workplace bonding. Social skills are shoved down our throats, whether or not we're particularly sociable people. The square peg, round hole metaphor certainly holds true here. Think of that episode of Gilmore Girls, where Rory Gilmore, perhaps one of television's finest depictions of an introvert, is told by her head teacher that she has to stop reading books at lunchtime and instead socialise with her classmates in order to get a better recommendation letter for college. Yet, as any fan of the show will know, Rory's ability to retreat into a world of books, a typically introvert characteristic, is simply fundamental to her personality, not to mention an improving academic habit that eventually leads her to be class valedictorian. In the same way that social skills can be a struggle, a great number of us lack the ability to spend time alone in a meaningful, productive, or enjoyable way. That's where solitude skills come in. Solitude skills, so termed by Dr. Virginia Thomas, author of the paper How to Be Alone, An Investigation of Solitude Skills, are the equivalent of social skills, but for time alone. They are what's needed to transform alone time into a positive solitude experience rather than an isolating, terrifying one. A cause close to my heart. Dr. Thomas's work chimes with me because solitude skills are essentially your alonement toolkit. The ability to relish your alone time brings meaning and value to your life. And that's something that's rarely emphasised as a personal strength, in the same way that having great social skills is. Alexandra Shulman, former editor of British Vogue, values this lesser celebrated skill set really highly. On my Alonement podcast, she said, "I think one of the great talents in life is to be happy on your own. People who are content on their own, who can also relate to other people, that is a great talent because at the end of the day, we are on our own, really, and it's important to be able to be on our own. I think it's also something that we don't value enough. It's a skill that's worth trying to perfect. Alone time, at its best, should be a self-actualizing experience. It's a chance to do the activities you love, like exercise or pursuing a creative hobby. It's to get to know yourself, to recognize your ambitions, and to look after yourself. In theory, great. The trouble is, if we lack solitude skills, often solo time can descend into the opposite. Expectation, a bubble bath, a chilled glass of Sauvignon Blanc, a copy of Middlemarch, and Radio 4 playing in the background, before changing into silk pyjamas and dancing around to Super Freak like Cameron Diaz at the start of Charlie's Angels. Reality, falling down an Instagram rabbit hole, binging on Ben and Jerry's, plus whatever chocolate you find in the back of the cupboard, and texting your ex. If your time spent alone looks more like the latter, then you will start to associate solitude with negative behaviour patterns that leave you feeling absolutely lousy. And I don't blame you. As you've probably already discovered, carving time out to be by yourself doesn't mean that, instantaneously, just like that, you're going to make the best of it. As Alan de Botton said on the podcast, it isn't enough to say you can know yourself from being alone, because there are ways of being alone that are actually not being with yourself. While some people's preferred escapism is a ménage à trois with Ben and Jerry, Alan gave the example of someone obsessively scrolling through the news to avoid introspection. Whatever it is, we all have our unhealthy habits which can creep in while we're supposed to be having quality me time. Maybe that's not surprising, given how many of us are so thoroughly unused to spending significant periods of time alone. What's more, we focus a lot as we grow older on learning how to develop social skills for being in the company of others, but rarely take the same proactive, critical approach towards honing our ability to thrive when we're alone. So, is it any wonder that our solitude skills are a little rusty? So how was that for you? I really hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast episode and the exclusive clip from the Alonement audiobook. You can order your copy now in hardback, Kindle and audiobook from Amazon, Waterstones, WH Smith and all good booksellers. I'll see you all soon for the next season of the podcast. And of course, you can follow Alonement on Instagram at AlonementOfficial or sign up to the free monthly newsletter at alonement.com. In the meantime, stay well, stay happy, and remember to keep valuing your relationship with yourself.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.